Welcome to Endeavors. Kick it, boys. Good evening, Radio Land, and welcome to Endeavors here on CJSF 90.1 FM, Burnaby, broadcasting from atop the mountain at Simon Fraser University. It's another beautiful day. Got some sunshine. No rainbows yet, but maybe we'll see some later on in the year. But time for some shorts, time for some short-sleeve shirts. Let's hope this we're not bombarded with thunderstorms. In addition to being on 90.1 FM, we are also on the internet at cjsf.ca. We stream, we podcast, so you can find this show, all the other CJSF shows right there, cjsf.ca. We do have a SoundCloud as well. And finally, we're on TELUS HD channel 7014. Technically, we have four interviews today. That might be a record, but two of them are grouped together, and you'll see why in a minute. We have award-winning Canadian author on the show, Jane Urquhart. She talks to us about her new novel, The Night Stages. It's stunning in scope, very linguistically powerful, very imagistic, it's been called elegiac, very complex, intertwining stories, and yet astutely Canadian. Only a Canadian could write this book. It takes place in the 1950s, sort of back and forth between the airport at Gander, Newfoundland, which was originally thought of as sort of the meeting point where, you know, Atlantic meets the Pacific. Didn't turn out that way, but that's what it was originally designed for. And this woman who's leaving her husband, leaving her lover, intertwined with that and her lover's younger brother and the artist who created the mural that she's at a company that she's sitting with at the Gander Airport. You'll also be hearing from a great artist. He's Austrian. He's a visual artist and designer. His name is Stefan Sagmeister, and he has a new exhibit opening here at the Museum of Vancouver called The Happy Project. And I spoke with him, as well as the museum's director of exhibits and curatorial, Gregory Dreiser. So we'll sort of get to the philosophy behind the Happy Project and how recent social science studies into happiness played a role in the creation of this project. It's art, but there's a lot of mixed media in it as well. And also, we have a music guest. I'm super excited. Coco Love Alcorn. She's currently touring a lot of little small towns. She'll be in Vancouver on Thursday, April 30th at the Backspace. For those of you listening out east, she'll be playing shows in Antigonish and Halifax in May. So you can check CocoLoveAlcorn.com for complete tour dates. So we will start off with a song from Coco. And this is the song, ER Room.
My man put a bullet in my chest. I should have been wearing a bullet vest. Bang, bang, boom, boom. Send me back into the ER room. My man drove a dagger through my heart. I should've known it from the start. Bang, bang, boom, boom. They sent me back into the ER room. Now all I need is a doctor to heal me. Then I'll find a new love. Ooh, one who can really feel me. My man said he loved me from his soul, then tore mine out and left a hole. Bang, bang, boom, boom, sent me back into the ER room. I wanna get some real love and stuff. I said, doctor, I need to know if you'll help me get good to go. My man never really was my man. I should've known it, I should've ran before. Bang, bang, boom, boom, he sent me packing to the ER room. Well, bang, bang, doctor's in, so I'll be out soon.
2011, entitled Play, and songs inspired by the birth of her daughter, Ellie. And you'll be hearing from Coco a little later on in the program. Right now we have author Jane Urquhart. She spoke to me last week about her fantastic new novel, Night Stages. Jane Urquhart, welcome to the show. Thanks so much for being here. Jane Urquhart, welcome to the show. Thanks so much for being here.
It's a pleasure.
So the new novel is Night Stages. I had a chance to read it. I thoroughly enjoyed it. One of the things that struck me was the use of language, the way you write sentences and the words, and it's a lot richer, perhaps, than other novels I've read in the past. Where does that come from for you? Does it come from your experience with poetry, or is that just a way you've always written, you think?
I think it's a combination, actually. I suspect that my previous life as a poet has something to do with it, but I've always been interested in how language is used. I've always wanted the language that I use to be in some way transformed from the everyday. I think that we too often overlook the fact that the way stories were conveyed in the past was by poetic epics, and of course the whole sort of notion of Western civilization was founded around things such as the Odyssey and the Iliad, which are verse histories, in a sense. The notion of cadence and music within the prose is one of the ways that I believe that people were able to remember things in the distant past. And also, it gives you a feeling that you're walking out of the ordinary and the everyday and into something a little different, a little more, shall we say, magical.
You mentioned history, and I know if you've set a lot of your books in the historical past, early 20th century. This one's the 1950s. What fascinates you about history, about the past sagas of Canada?
Well, partly it's the past sagas of Canada. I guess it's the past generally as well. And this particular saga, although I suppose the now of the book takes place in Gander Airport, Newfoundland, where a woman is looking at a mural painted by a Canadian artist. The real narrative of the book unfolds in Ireland, in County Kerry, and that's the place where she has been, which she has just left in honor and hoping to get to New York and get stranded in Gander, as happened quite often, actually, in the 1950s, when every plane that was transatlantic had to refuel in Gander Airport. But to answer your question, the business of the past, first of all, I think that anything we do, any sentence that we make takes place in the past, simply because by the time we finish saying it or writing it, it's in the, what we're writing about or talking about has moved into the past. But I'm Yes, I am interested in the more distant past. I think, in a way, I can see it, or I think I can see it whole. I'd probably be fooling myself if I fully believed that I could see it more clearly. But there is a sense of completion about it that I kind of like, and a sense of, I doubt I would ever write about the ancient historical past. I don't think that interests me as much. I believe it has to be something that I feel that I've touched the hand that actually knew the time, and that would be true of the 1950s, and really right back into the 19th century, in the sense that my grandmother was born in the late 19th century. So I have to have some real contact with someone who had some real contact with the time in question. I wouldn't write about the medieval period or Renaissance or anything that far away.
The decision to set it in Ireland, especially in that area, because at least to me, Ireland evokes this place that's not only beautiful and picturesque, but also brings a sense of longing and melancholy.
I suppose that may be true. I lived part-time in the part of Ireland in which the book is set for the last 20 years. So I feel now that I really know the area and know the history of the area and know the... I know the landscape and the people, in fact, in a way that I wouldn't have had I started this book, say, 30 years ago. And yes, there is all of that, but I think that's part of human nature. I'm not sure it's specific to Ireland. The Irish have a tendency to be able to express themselves rather well when it comes to sadness and loss and things of that nature. And also, I believe that they really have a particular gift with language, as evidenced by the great number of Nobel Prizes that they have won, especially when you think of it in relation to the population of the country, which is only about 3 million.
How does that play in overall to what I think is one of the themes of the book, longing, lost, belonging, wanting to be a part of something?
Well, I think that with the Irish, they've been forced to leave Ireland in great flocks and droves over the years, my own family included, on my mother's side, the Quinns, who had to leave in the middle of the potato famine, as so many did. And I think that any diaspora, which the Irish are, usually end up with two homelands, one which is the place where they now live, and the other one is the place that either they or someone generations back had to leave behind. And I suspect that the original homeland becomes a sort of sacred homeland in a way, a place, a sacred land to which one always wants in some part of one's psyche to return, even though in many, many cases it's just not possible.
The decision to include a real-life historical artist as a character in the book, what made you decide to do that?
It wasn't really a fully conscious decision. I think that people believe that when someone is writing that they are plotting or planning things, and that may be true with some writers, but it's actually not true with me at all. Each day when I approach the desk, I do so kind of wondering what on earth is going to happen today, because I don't have a preconceived notion beyond a couple of characters and a couple of settings, really, when I sit down to write a book. But it seemed to me that when I found that I wanted to write about the character of the artist who conceived the mural and who executed it, I felt as though he were a kind of Greek chorus to the rest of what was going on in the book, and also a kind of companion to me, because what I really want to do when I sit down to write a book is make art. The question, I suppose, that remains and will not be answered for a very long time, not by me or anyone else, is whether or not I've succeeded. But that's my main goal. I'm not interested in making something that will turn into a screenplay or something that, is an easy read or none of those, or even something that sells, to be quite honest. I've been extremely fortunate in that regard, but that has never been my intention. I just want to make something that's different and original, and I want it to be art.
I like how you bring that up because, you know, in the book, we're taking into Kenneth's journey and how he observes all the characters that inspired him to create the mural that he did. And I'm wondering if there was a similar process for you in any way in writing this book.
Well, I think probably it had something to do with age when it comes to me. I wanted to explore his apprenticeship and how experiences that he came across worked themselves in a kind of unconscious way into the mural that he was creating. And those experiences may have been travels, which would have made sense for this particular mural because it's in a arrivals and departure lounge in what was supposed to be the most significant airport pretty much in the world. Didn't work out that way, but that's what the Canadian government had in mind. But also his education, what that did to him, his early relationships, some of the advice that he received over the years, and just his emotional reactions to being in the world, in a sense. And I think that often art is the result of our own emotional reactions to being in the world, whether let's hope that it becomes transformed and turns itself into something else. I mean, I'm not suggesting, though memoir itself is a marvelous, marvelous genre, and increasingly so, where people are able to express themselves. I'm more interested in fiction, so the transformation of the emotional experiences that we have in life is extremely important to me, and I believe was sort of part of what I hoped was going into the character of Kenneth as he was working on his mural. He was remembering things and re-experiencing things.
How personable does art have to be for you, whether it's something that you've created yourself or something that you're reading or watching or observing? What sort of connection do you need to have with the product?
Well, I think we all want to relate in some way or another to what it is that we're reading or looking at or experiencing. Now, that can be, you know, when you say that, you can't, or it need not be identification of a personal nature. It can be an intellectual relationship that you develop with something that is perhaps more abstract. But I also think that every now and then you'll find an echo, especially in literature, of an experience you yourself have had. And it's a very fulfilling experience to find yourself mirrored, or your experience mirrored in literature. I think what it does is it dignifies human experience in some way or another, and that's what is one of the most satisfying things about reading.
Would you say that any part of you or any part of your life experiences is present in the night stages?
Yes, absolutely. Well, first of all, I think that one has to to be able to convey what's going on emotionally, one has to have had at least some experience, I think, with those emotions. Imagination can only really take you so far. That's the first thing. Now, when it comes to the narrative itself, of course, no, that's not me. But I certainly do know the landscape in which my main character operates. And when I say my main character, I'm of two minds as to who that character may be, whether it's the young man who eventually enters the bicycle race, or whether it's my female character who ends up in Gander Airport. It was a toss-up all the way. I often will find when I'm writing a novel that a young boy or a young man walks into the novel and is supposed to be a minor character and takes over the entire novel.
Did you find that to be the case with Kieran in this book?
I did, yes. And I let him do it because I thought he was great.
One thing that always struck me is when I talk to writers, you know, writing in the gender that's not them. How for you do you connect with writing in the male voice or about the male voice?
I think one of the reasons why it's often a very young, a boy person who walks into my novel if they're of a different gender is because perhaps they haven't been fully and absolutely gendered by the time I meet them. But that being said, I did write an entire novel, The Underpainter, from the point of view of a man. And not a very sympathetic man either. What I found that time was that I began the novel in the third person, but I very quickly discovered that the only way that I could write from the point of view of a man in the first person was to write in the first person. In other words, I couldn't do it in the third person. I couldn't write about him and still have it be his point of view. I had to be looking out through his eyes. As far as Kieran was concerned, hard for me to explain, really, although I did, I began when he was a child, and in fact, throughout most of the book, he is still quite a young man, and I think that may have something to do with it.
You mentioned that, when you sit down to write, you're not entirely sure where the day is going to take you, but once you've actually finished the writing, how much do you go back and edit?
Oh, huge amount, but not right away. There's a period during which I work on the first draft, kind of compose things and let things happen and get to know the characters and get to know the landscapes and watch what happens, essentially. I put my characters under pressure and see what happens to them. And I don't revise the first draft, but what I do is go back and rewrite the whole book at least 7 or 8 times, and then it goes to my publisher, who in turn, and then there's an editorial process there as well. So it's not, it takes a long time, let's put it that way. That's why it takes me 4 or 5 years. A lot of things. What's interesting, though, is that the first draft doesn't change that much narratively. It usually stays the same in terms of narrative. It changes in structure.
How did you feel that, with this book in particular, it jumps back and forth between Tam, Kenneth, and sort of Niall and Kieran. What was the main challenge for you in finding that balance of all three stories?
Well, I felt that, first of all, obviously, there is a connection, and it's a very tenuous connection, but a connection nevertheless. And the connection was, of course, the mural in Gander, which Tam, who was involved with Niall, was looking at after she left him, and Niall being Kieran's brother, and Kenneth being the person who painted the mural. I didn't want this to be a conventional book, and that's one of the great joys of being as old as I am, is that I'm not at a stage where I'm about to carve out my career. I don't feel that I have to be safe. I was very, very eager to explore different ways of connecting things, so that I was hoping that imagery connected things, or that relationships echoed one another in the various stories, but not in any kind of blatant sort of way, because that kind of easy sort of connectedness doesn't interest me all that much. I want the book to teach me something as well. I don't want to be the preachy teachy one.
Is subtlety more of a challenge to write than being overt?
I think it might be, in that you have to watch it. You have to pay attention. If you want to remain subtle, you have to pay attention to the part of yourself that wants to make things more rational. And you have to keep that part down. Now, luckily for me, I don't have a part of myself it's a very weak part of myself that wants to be rational, so it's not all that difficult for me to keep it down. But for others, I know it is.
How would you mentioned this, this book can take you 4 or 5 years. Do you enjoy a long writing process?
Yes. And in fact, I think that's why I stopped writing poetry. Or I didn't stop. I think the poetry got into the prose, essentially. I became dissatisfied with a single lyric poem. I found that I was writing in series, and then I was writing in other people's voices in series, and then all of a sudden I thought, I think maybe I should actually see what happens. In fact, my first novel, The Whirlpool, was an attempt on my part to write a very, 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 very long prose poem. And it took a long time before it identified itself as a novel. So there's a bunch of things going on.
With the sort of the advent of ebooks and the closing of a lot of stores like Barnes & Noble, a lot of people feel that the traditional hard case literature is in trouble. What do you say to that?
Well, I find that difficult to believe, partly because I'm very fortunate in that I have extremely loyal and extremely committed readers who are of many different ages and both genders and all kinds of backgrounds and things like that. So especially when I'm on a book tour like right now, I find it hard to believe that literature is going to die as either a quick and dirty death or a slow and painful death, simply because of the numbers of people who seem to be eager for it. I can't see it happening. I mean, I could be absolutely wrong, but I don't really think so, because I think people are kind of starved for content. There's a lot of quick stuff out there that is gratifying in the short term, but you know, I think people like to develop a relationship with what it is that they're reading, as well as read things that are perhaps more easily digestible.
Well, on that note, I was reading a review before the interview today, and it said that The Night Stages is not a book to whip through; rather, it's one to savor. Do you like it when works that either you've written or that other people have written take a little bit longer to read rather than a book maybe like Harry Potter that you could read in a day or two?
Yeah, I do. I personally do. But that does not mean that I'm, shall we say, I'm against the Harry Potter syndrome. I think that really there's room for everything. I think one of the things that we forget about literature and about books in general is that it's very much like music that way. You have popular music, you have pop music and rock music, etc., on the one hand. You have classical music on the other, and neither cancels the other out. So there's all kinds of possibilities within the world of narrative and storytelling. I mean, starting with, you know, soap operas in the afternoon and working their way right through to Shakespeare. And I think there's room for absolutely all of it.
And finally, I know that your daughter's become a writer herself. And would you have any advice to young aspiring writers?
I would say if you're in it for the fame, you should probably forget it, if that's your primary motive. Not just because it's almost impossible to either get or maintain, but just because it's the wrong impulse. I think that real writers have always been readers. That's the other thing. If suddenly overnight you want to be a writer and you haven't really read widely and deeply, it would seem to me that you may be successful. I mean, in the sort of outside world sense of that term, but as far as making art, which is, as I said before, what it is that I try to do, and whether or not I succeed is debatable, then, you know, it's a whole different kind of impulse. So I would say that on the one hand, and also don't suffer from the illusion that you're really going to make any money, because it's very hard to do, to sell books at all, never mind sell enough to make a living.
Well, the book is The Night Stages. It's a very, very powerful tale that has so many layers, so many elements. I encourage all the listeners to check it out, and anybody who likes Canlit, history, art, Ireland, you name it. There's something in it for everybody. Jane Urquhart, thanks so much for your time today.
Thanks a lot.
All right, cheers. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
And that was Jane Urquhart, and I spoke to her from Vancouver last week. We have a couple of announcements, and then we're going to get to an interview with Coco Love Elkhorn.
The
On CGSF 90.1 FM Burnaby, CGSF.ca. The great musician coming up. She's currently touring a lot of little local small towns. She'll be in Vancouver on April 30th at the Backspace. In May, she'll be playing in Dartmouth, Halifax, Antigonish, among other maritime provinces for my listeners out east. And I spoke with her on Friday about her new album, Motherhood and the Tour. This is Coco Love Alcorn. Coco Love Alcorn, thanks so much for joining me today.
Hey, thanks for having me.
So you're about to start a tour coming up here. And what struck me about your tour and what I found interesting about it is that you're playing in smaller, intimate places that you wouldn't necessarily play on a regular bigger tour. What gave you the idea to play at like little cafes or pottery studios in small towns?
Okay, cool. I'm launching a crowdfunding campaign on Monday. I mean today.
Yeah.
Yeah, and over at pledgemusic.com/CocoLoveAlcorn, you can find that. And I'm launching a crowdfunding campaign for my new album, and the working title is The Spirit Sessions. And I thought it would be really cool to be out there singing some of these songs that I've been writing in really small, like, intimate community venues and house concerts and things like that, and kind of getting people excited about the crowdfunding campaign and the songs, just, in actual live moments.
When you do a house concert or a private show, how would you compare the atmosphere of that to when you're playing at like a nightclub or a more standard music venue?
Yeah. There's a lot of differences. I guess for right now, something I really liked about, or part of what led to this tour that I'm doing, is these shows were not booked that long ago. It actually started with a few months ago, me on a whim, which is fairly Coco-y, on a whim, just thinking, gosh, spring and summer is coming up. And it would be really nice to go out and play some shows in BC and in Nova Scotia. So I actually just put a post on my Facebook page. And it was like, not enough time to book a tour in big venues and get all the proper promotions together and all of that stuff. But I just thought, I feel like going and singing these songs to real people. So I just put a notice on my Facebook page. I said, hey, does anyone want me to come sing at your house in BC or Nova Scotia this spring or summer? And then, like, in a day and a half, I got 58 invites. And it's been a little bit of a hornet's nest kind of sorting through that. But it's really cool because it felt very direct to fans. Yeah. It felt very just whoever happened to check their Facebook wall that day, and with whatever the Facebook algorithms, whichever walls the Facebook algorithms decided to post my little query to, those are the shows I'm essentially going to play.
Now I know your last album, Play, released in 2011, was inspired a lot by the birth of your daughter Ellie.
That's right. Yeah.
How has that event and parenthood in general changed enhanced your creative process?
Cool. Okay. I made that album when she was a little baby at home, and then we toured it across Canada. And then with her, like, Ellie came with me, and then the last 3.5 years, I've been mostly living up in this beautiful community, Owen Sound in Ontario, and I've been a mom, and I've occasionally been flying off and doing shows, but only ever leaving home for a few days at a time. And this whole time, I knew I would make another record, and I knew I would get out touring again, but I was waiting till the time was right.
waiting till the time was right for Ellie, and also till I felt creatively like I had something that I really, really wanted to share. And about a year and a half ago, I was having a conversation with a friend of mine, James Keelahan, and he was helping me figure out, you know, what was next, because I always have 10 ideas of the next album I want to make. And he said, yeah, but if you could pick one, what do you really want to do? And I mentioned a few ideas, and one idea really stuck out, which was to write songs inspired by the human spirit. And I think that's really come out of this time, because in my heart, I could have been happy to never tour again, to just stay in Owen Sound with this amazing family, with this amazing community, beautiful nature all around, and just cook delicious meals each night and go for bike rides, and there's a happy life. But it was my spirit that was feeling restless. There's something about there's something about singing to people and with people, and those moments that happen in live shows where everyone in a room connects, and I'm sort of the conduit for all that energy. And I don't know, it feels like a spiritual thing.
is you know, she's about five now, is if I'm correct. Is touring, like, how would you describe touring now when she's just about to start school versus touring when she was just, you know, a few months to a year old?
Okay, so I guess that's another part of this whole story, and it ties into what we were talking about before. I could have waited till I released the new record to do a lot of touring again. I've been barely doing any, but when I was getting ready to launch this crowdfunding campaign and starting to do some pre-production on these songs and feeling really passionate about these songs, I just thought, no, I don't want to wait another year and a bit to be out there singing these songs. I want to sing them now. And Ellie's, yeah, she's getting close to five, and she's a lot more independent now, and she's going to be staying in Owen Sound sometimes when I go away, but then she's also going to be coming with me on some of the tours. And the great thing is she's excited. She knows she's coming to Nova Scotia with me in May.
Yeah.
And she's excited to go see Grandma Grace and her cousins. and she's a really good girl, and it'll be great to have her with me. And yeah, so that was part of the way that this touring is this spring and summer, is me wanting to do that direct-to-fan and very personal style of touring, because it's a transition.
Yeah.
I'm transitioning out of being in mom mode and back into touring artist mode. So this feels nice and gentle, going and singing in some smaller venues and some living rooms. I'm going to do six or seven festivals this summer, and and then we'll go from there.
I know one of the themes of your music is bicycles. I know you're quite an avid cyclist. What is about for you how would you say, you know, cycling affects you from a creative point of view, and why do bicycles for you give you good songwriting material?
Okay, yeah, another good question. Obviously, cycling is healthy and cool, but, you know, again, like, the spirit is something that is tricky to talk about. I find it a little bit awkward to talk about, but I'm really trying to find the right language, because it's such a beautiful and powerful thing that we all have, and an energy source that we all tap into. And when I get on a bike and I'm coasting along, feeling the wind in my hair, it feels like the closest thing I know to what it would feel like to fly. I don't have wings. I've never flown. I don't know. But it feels sort of like flying. It feels very liberating and empowering, and, you know, you're propelling yourself forward, and you can dig in and push harder and go faster, and I don't know. It's just it's a beautiful thing.
You've talked a lot about you know, the spirit and the human spirit, and about how that's inspiring your next album. How would you describe for you what that is, that spirit, that sort of you know, extrasensory force that guides you?
Yeah. again, it's tricky to put into words, and I think that's why I'm compelled to make this record, is I can try to hone in on what I'm trying to say with words, and then when I'm not quite all the way there, the music can tell part of the story. I can just open my mouth and sing and try to get to that connected place. But the spirit is something that we can lean on when times are hard. And it's also an energy that we tap into when times are amazing. You know, when you're celebrating, I think your spirit is involved. I think you tap into your spirit when you're connecting with other people, when you're connecting with deeper parts of yourself, when you're having really connected moments. Nature, music, sensuality, amazing food, riding your bicycle, swimming in the water with the warm sun on your face. Like, all of these things are times when I feel my spirit rise, I guess. Yeah.
Well, it's definitely a great look into the creative process and the human process. And Coca will be here in Vancouver April 30th at the Backspace in Vancouver. You can check her website at cocolovealcorn.com/tour. She will have all the details up there for you. Coco Love Alcorn, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you so much. It was really nice chatting with you.
Me too, and I hope to see you at the show on the 30th.
Sounds good.
Cheers.
That was Coco Love Alcorn, and I spoke to her on Friday. Okay, we have a final interview coming up. Stefan Sagmeister is an artist originally from Austria, now living in New York, whose new installation at the Museum of Vancouver opened on Thursday. It is entitled The Happy Project, and I had a chance to speak with him and the museum's director of exhibitions and curatorial, Gregory Dreiser, on Tuesday. I'm here with Gregory Dreiser, who's the
director of curatorial and engagement
here at the Museum of Vancouver, and we're talking about Stefan Sagmeister's new exhibit. What made you want to bring this exhibit to here?
Yeah. Well, I arrived here in Vancouver and at the museum last July, and one of the first things I discovered was the Vancouver Foundation report. You're probably familiar with it. It says that there's a civic malaise, that Vancouverites are isolated and lonely. I'm not sure how true that is, but it really resonated with a lot of people, and there's a lot of things going on in the city. So we felt that the Happy Show is a good moment to bring the Happy Show here.
It's kind of ironic, because I think there was an article 2 days ago that said Vancouver was the unhappiest city to live in.
Yes.
What do you make of that?
Well, I think, who knows if it's really true? I mean, it's also one of the best places to live. And it has a lot of people who are passionately committed to the city, but I do think there's a lot of change going on here in terms of, new people coming and real estate situation. There's a lot of things going on that are causing people, I think, some discomfort.
What is it about an exhibit of this type, where he's writing on the walls and he's got, a lot of sort of audience participation, if you will. How can this engage us and audiences in ways perhaps other mediums can't?
Yes. Well, I think the whole environment, it's an immersive environment. Stefan Sagmeister has really created something that engages people, and in all the sensations, in sound, color, light, and there are many opportunities to interact with things. And so it's definitely, no matter what you would like to engage people in, engaging them emotionally is the key, and this exhibition definitely does that.
This exhibition in sort of visual art as a whole, what can it tell us about ourselves and the human condition?
You mean the visual?
Yeah.
Whoa.
And sort of how we structured the whole thing, because it struck me when I was walking, like, oh yeah, I never put much thought into it, but I kind of agree with what he's saying.
Yeah. Well, I think there are a lot of points and ideas in this exhibition that are very engaging and interesting to people, because everyone probably thinks, well, they know what makes them happy, but actually that is not really true. Many of us, maybe most of us, don't really know things that make us happy. For example, most people think that making a lot more money is going to make them happy, and that's actually, many studies have shown that's not at all true. and there are other areas like that. So I think that this exhibition, and especially the way it uses Stefan's own personal experience and his visual representations, very unusual, startling, amusing representations of what he's learned, is going to really get people to think about some of those things.
Why, you know, as someone who's sort of on the outside of this exhibit, why is it important that that art has that personal touch to it?
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think that when art is has impact or is successful, it's got to be emotionally engaging. People need to connect to it in some way. And as you probably know, even when people go to some art exhibitions and they can't connect, they actually try. You know, they try in any way possible. You know, they'll look at the frame that's around the painting instead of the painting itself. But so I think the fact that the Happy Show has all these issues that affect everyone's everyday lives, it's a guaranteed connection.
When you go to an exhibit, just as an observer, what do you like to see? What connects to you?
Well, I mean, the things I like to see are, I like to be surprised, very surprised, and certainly the Happy Show has that. I love to have things that connect, like anyone, things that connect to my own life. And I think that's really critical for any exhibition, is to know your audience, know to some extent what they're thinking, and try to engage with that. And that, again, that's important for any exhibition, and certainly is happens here.
Like, this is a, I would describe this as kind of almost a mixed media exhibit, and it seems to me, along with a lot of other forms of culture, that art has evolved over the many years. How would you describe the evolution of art in the last half century or so?
That I can't. Sorry, that question I can't answer. Sorry, that's too much, too big, too big for me. Sorry.
What would you say is your favorite part of this exhibit?
I think I like the gumballs. It's there's a row of gumballs with yellow, you know, gumball machines with yellow gumballs in them, very tall columns. And every person that comes here takes one away from 1 to 10 according to how happy they are. And after a little while, it's going to kind of broadcast. It'll be a graph of the level of Vancouverites' well-being.
Great. Well, Gregory Dresser, thank you so much for your time.
Okay, thank you.
Cheers. I'm here with artist Stefan Sagmeister, and we're here at the pre-opening of his new exhibit. What inspired you to create an exhibit like this?
Well, basically, I'm a designer, so I had done many years ago a talk on design and happiness for other designers, and there was just always fantastic feedback about that subject, and then when I found myself in Indonesia, every 7 years we close the studio and I do a year's worth of figuring things out, trying all the stuff that I don't quite have time to do in the busy studio time. And I was looking for a project that had some sort of meaning. And that old talk came to my mind again, and that it had gotten good feedback. And then the idea to create came up that I could create a film on happiness, a documentary film. And out of that film, or while we were working on that film, the museum asked us to do a show on design, which I wasn't really interested in because we had done so many of them before. But I suggested to them, why don't we do one on happiness, and they went for it.
You mentioned their sabbatical, and what does... Why is that such a big part of your life, and what does that allow you to do, at least creatively?
So, as I mentioned, every 7 years we close the studio and do experiments. It turned out that if you have a year to think about something, the results are very different than if you have a weekend to think about something. So, if nothing else, it puts my studio into the situation that we would do work that's different from the other design studios. And that actually also turned out comes at a premium, because if so much of the work that's been done out there is basically exchangeable, if you do work that nobody else does, you can actually want more money for it. And so very strangely, and I didn't expect this at all, we actually made more money by not working. Which was definitely not the goal, but that was one of the side outcomes. One of the major outcomes, I would say, is that when I was a student, I went into design because I really felt it was a calling. That's really what I wanted to do. I didn't care if I would get paid on it or not. That's what I wanted to do. And then as I was going into the field and I was doing it as a professional, that calling became more and more of a career and ultimately more and more of a job. And I think many people experience that. Like they do something that they really love, but just by repetition, it becomes a career, which is still better than a job. I mean, you still really care about it, but you're not quite sure if all that hard work is really worth your while. And then when it becomes a job, it's basically a 9-to-5 kind of thing. You can't wait until it's Friday night and that you actually are off from it. And I find that the sabbatical, by far, the most effective strategy to make sure that my work remains a calling. And in that, it's incredibly helpful to do work that I believe in, to work that my clients believe in, to work that people who look at the work believe in. It's just something that's automatic, more real. And there's so much bullshit out there. I mean, most of it. I mean, most of everything that we see and is crap. And I'm not saying that the stuff that we do is not crap. We make a lot of crap. But there is a desire to stop that every once in a while.
There's been a lot of sort of social science research lately into being happy. You know, they're talking about the gross national happiness as a metric versus, you know, GDP.
Sure.
How much of that research did you look into, and how much of that played a role in the creation of this?
I actually, in the beginning, looked a lot into that. I was very fascinated by the field of positive psychology. I think that's what you're referring to. Basically started by Marty Seligman in Philadelphia, the first place where this exhibition started, and I had the chance actually to meet the guy who started that all. He used to be the head of the American Association of Psychologists and Psychiatrists, and had this idea that it's kind of crazy that the whole field just looks into pathology and doesn't look into the positive side of things at all. Like, doesn't look into what it means to be healthy in psychology. And so he basically was the founding father of that field, but many, many people followed and researched that. And there was basically, in the beginning, they even had to invent the terminology because there was no terms in psychology to talk about well-being that would make sense. So I looked at many of those scientists, met many of them. One of them became our scientific advisor, Jonathan Haidt, but also met many of the others, read their papers, and was quite fascinated by it. Ultimately, through reading them, I found that whenever any of the scientists talked about something that they experienced themselves, I became so much more interested immediately, even though it didn't really make sense. I should have been more interested in a survey that they had commissioned, but if it was personal, I was so much more interested. And I found that while I myself am not a scientist, it would be helpful for me to reduce the whole exhibition down on my own experience, for one thing, because I felt that it will be more relatable, but also because on my own happiness, I really am the world's number one expert.
You had mentioned this whole thing kind of started with a documentary film. Mm-hmm. When can we expect that out, and how do you find working in the medium of film differ from sort of the visual art mixed mm-hmm. media aspect?
So I think the film should be done in about a month, and then we go through the film festival so that we are actually applying for Toronto.
Oh,
so
wow.
We will see if we will get in. The numbers are very much against us. And I have to say, I find it much more difficult to work in film than to work, let's say, in the exhibition. I think that the exhibition is much closer to what I do as a graphic designer, basically the combination of images and words to create, to communicate complex content in a somewhat, hopefully, delightful manner. I mean, that's basically the definition of graphic design. In film, I find that much more difficult. And the making of the film proved, without any doubt, that I can become utterly miserable by making a film on happiness. But it also showed me, it also created an incredible appreciation for other people's films. I think that as a viewer, without knowing it, I became unbelievably sophisticated just because I've seen so much. But that doesn't mean that as a doer I'm sophisticated. And there, that discrepancy between knowing what is good as a viewer but not knowing how to achieve it as a doer created a lot of anxiety as well.
Well, we look forward to the film, and I'm looking forward to the official opening of this exhibit. Stefan Sagmeister, thanks so much.
Thanks a lot.
And that was Stefan Sagmeister. Spoke to him at the Museum of Vancouver. That's the show for today. My thanks to Stefan Sagmeister, Gregory Dreiser, Coco of Alcorn, and Jane Urquhart. This has been Endeavors on CGSF 90.1 FM Burnaby, cgsf.ca. Stay tuned for No Channel for Old Men with Chris. And we're going to take you out with Coco Love Alcorn's Electricity. Thanks for tuning in, and we'll see you next week. Bye, everybody. Bye.
Making my hair go fuzzy is like electricity. It comes and goes for free. It's like elasticity. Our molecular biology is a ticking bomb of chemistry. So let's stop talking history and just let it be. So glad we figured it out with our little chat. So glad we figured it out where our love is at. You're making my heart a drummer with a boom boom melody, skipping a beat or two in perfect harmony. With our music we can improvise, it's counterpoint then compromise. The future's wearing a disguise, so just leave it where it lies. So glad we figured it out with our little chat. So glad we figured it out where our love is at. Every minute, every second, every day, yeah, 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 I got something to say. Ooh, I just wanna live in the moment, yeah, 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 I wanna live that way. Wait a minute, wait a second, wait a year. Well, no, 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 that's living in fear. Well, there ain't no worry and there ain't no hurry. I'm just talking about living right here. So glad we figured it out with our little chat. So glad we figured it out where our love is at. So glad we figured it out with our little chat. So glad.